Welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. In a few minutes, for the principal segment of our show, I'll be speaking with Townsend Davis about his new book on the American Civil Rights Movement. But first, let's look back at this week, August 10th through the 16th, in history. On August 10th, 1921, the 39-year-old Franklin Delano Roosevelt was stricken with polio during a stay at his summer home. On August 11, 1951, the nation watched its first full-color televised baseball game between the Braves and the Dodgers on WCBS-TV in New York City. On August 12, 1898, Hawaii became a U.S. territory. On August 13, 1961, East Germany began construction of the Berlin Wall. On August 15, 1620, the Mayflower set sail from England for America with 102 pilgrims aboard. And on August 16, 1977, Elvis Presley died at his Graceland mansion in Memphis, Tennessee. He was 42 years old. Turning to this week's history in the news, we have two items, both on the Holocaust. First, a Berlin historian has moved us a step closer to determining exactly when Adolf Hitler ordered the extermination of Europe's Jews. Christian Gerlach has located an entry in SS Chief Heinrich Himmler's office diary, found in the KGB archives in Moscow, in which Himmler refers to a meeting he had had with Hitler on December 18, 1941. In reference to that meeting, Himmler wrote, quote, "Jewish question, dash, to be wiped out as partisans." Himmler had been using the partisan excuse to justify killing Jews in the Soviet Union since the summer of 1941. But here, Gerlach explains, he used the term Jewish question, not Eastern Jews or Soviet Jews, giving the note broader implications. Looked at in the context of other developments at the time, Gerlach concludes Himmler was referring to a, quote, basic decision of Hitler to murder all the Jews of Europe. And also in reference to the Holocaust, a recent survey conducted for the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., found that 21% of Americans didn't know or weren't sure whether Jews were murdered in gas chambers during World War II. 19% answered false when asked whether the Holocaust took place during World War II. Another 19% weren't sure. On the other hand, 80% of those polled picked the Holocaust as providing one of history's most important lessons, and 66% wanted to know more about it. Among the reasons they cited for the importance of studying the Holocaust were that it might prevent another Holocaust, that it helps us understand the dangers of persecution and hatred, and that from it we can learn about the potential consequences of abuse of power. You're listening to Talking History.
Oh, Jesus, hear me praying, hear the words I'm saying, voice my soul and water from on high. The word of sinner on me, no evil thoughts can bind me, oh Savior, if you need.
The number of books that's been written on the American Civil Rights Movement is legion. Nevertheless, among the most recently published, one stands out from the rest for its unique approach to the subject. That is Weary Feet, Rested Souls, A Guided History of the Civil Rights Movement, written by Townsend Davis and published by W.W. Norton. Weary Feet, Rested Souls is part history, part travelogue. It's not only a good study of the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s in the South, but it's also a history written in the form of a guided tour of the sites associated with the movement. The New York Times has described the book as useful to students and entertaining to general readers, while the New York Law Journal has praised it as offering an excellent launching pad into the expansive universe of the civil rights struggle. Here to tell us more about Weary Feet, Rested Souls is the author, Townsend Davis. Mr. Davis is a senior litigator for Dibovoys and Plimpton in New York City. Thank you, Mr. Davis, for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
It's a great book. I enjoyed reading it very much.
Glad to hear that.
Let me ask you right off the bat, because it is its unique quality here, how did you come about thinking of taking this approach? What prompted you to take this sort of mix of history travelogue approach?
It started during my first job out of law school. I was clerking for a judge in Savannah, Georgia. And as part of our job, we would travel around to courthouses in Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. and hear oral arguments. And during my free time, I would sort of rummage around the town trying to find out more. And I was in Birmingham for the first time, and I thought about the momentous struggles that took place there, the marches during the movement that I had only read about, and went in search of the 16th Street Baptist Church, which is the subject of Spike Lee's movie as well,
right.
Poor Little Girls. At any rate, the hotel clerk at my hotel had no idea where this place was. It turned out to be about 5 blocks from where I was staying. But at any rate, I started just keeping notes that year. About a year later, I was hoping that someone else would come up with this book so I wouldn't have to do it. But after a few years, no one really had put together something that showed where things were, just where are the landmarks of this period in history. There were almost none at that time. That was 1990.
Sure.
Now, of course, there have been quite a few that have been put up, but that's how it started.
And I think this is a great contribution, because most people who read a standard history text really can't follow the sites as a guide like that. But
right. Most historians take a chronological approach, which forces them to jump around from place to place. And people are very vague, as I was, about, wait, did that actually happen in Birmingham, or is that in somewhere in Mississippi, or was that in South Carolina? I think that people tend to, because the national news covered it so steadily, they didn't really distinguish between people might find it hard to remember that there were different movements in different towns.
Right. I should tell the listeners so they'll know that you really covered it both ways. The book is basically organized alphabetically by state, with the sites within each state arranged then in chronological order. But then you add at the end sort of an inclusive chronology, so that if anyone seems they're getting lost in the state's activities, they can look at the larger event and place what they're seeing in that larger civil rights context. So it's cuts both ways, and it's a wonderful organization.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, you mentioned in the book, you suggest in focusing on these individual sites that this is really, the civil rights is really a grassroots movement as, let's say, opposed to a top-down movement. Is this your sense of what the civil rights movement was all about?
Yes, very much so. And especially after doing this book, that view was only reinforced. Because what I saw was that much of the movement was driven by the people who boycotted, who organized meetings, who drove, who housed the Freedom Summer volunteers, the people who did sort of mundane, everyday organizational tasks. And Dr. King was, and others were very important in terms of fundraising and getting the attention of the press. But frequently, since Dr. King couldn't be everywhere at once, he would come parachuting into a town, give a rousing speech, and maybe stay for a week, maybe go to jail, and then disappear.
Hmm.
And it was the people who were in these towns that had to deal with the police for the next decade and to keep on pushing with the local government to make changes and to follow through. So I was very impressed with a lot of the local people that I met, and they really are the heroes of this, because once you're determined to go to local places, which is what I did, you're going to end up talking to local people who are still living there, and there are plenty of them.
And even King himself is a product of that grassroots movement. He starts locally, then he goes national.
Yes, that's right. He certainly did start off with a bang in 1955 with the bus boycott in Montgomery.
When you went through these sites, if you could categorize them, what single kind of site tended to predominate among these meeting places for the civil rights movement?
Well, there always were churches. That was kind of the bedrock, because that was the safest meeting place, the place where people would be, although police did go to meetings in Birmingham, for the most part, people in a black church would be left alone. And so it was a very useful sanctuary for the movement in the early days. But it really surprised me how many important things happened in all sorts of places. There's a bowling alley in Orangeburg, South Carolina that became the focal point of protests in 1968. Lots of barbershops and cafes and places like that where people congregated and had meetings and decided to made decisions that may not have seemed so momentous then, but which had ended up having national and international consequences later.
Well, except for churches, you seem to label all the rest of these, or the common ground of all the rest of these, is they had to be black-owned or black-run organizations. Is that the case?
Some were. Most were, but not all. In Birmingham, the realty office Sid Meier, for example, was a negotiating haven, a kind of a neutral ground, owned by a white real estate agent developing. But primarily because the communities were segregated, the movement kind of centered around a particular neighborhood, a black neighborhood, where you would have a church and a restaurant and a school with, all within walking distance. It surprised the geography of it became much clearer to me when I went there, and you would see the things that I'd envisioned in books being sort of miles apart ended up just being right down the street from each other. And if you went and talked to one activist, they'd say, oh, you know, I just spoke with the other famous person you know who lives two blocks away. So it was really a neighborhood-based, the movement organization was neighborhood-based.
Well, neighborhood-based, broadly based, many different kinds of organizations and establishments, but churches predominated, and you mentioned in your book, you used the phrase, the church was more than a meeting house. What do you mean
yes.
by that?
Well, what I mean is that it dovetailed very well with the gospel itself. I've often wondered and been asked, was the civil rights movement primarily a religious movement, or was it primarily a political movement? And that's a very hard question to answer. But the point is that the church is a gathering place for both. That is a mass meeting, which was primarily for the purpose of organizing to change the voting laws, was conducted as a service with prayers and with hymns and with freedom songs, which were basically hymns that had been modified to fit the times. And so it was a mixture of those things, and the liberating aspects of the gospel were conducive to what they were fighting for in concrete terms. So it really was, I don't think that could have happened in any other type of place. The church had provided a unique haven for that.
And that,
sort of.
That's an interesting point, too, because we generally don't mix politics and religion in white churches, yet it's very common in black churches, especially during the civil rights movement.
Well, I'm not sure. I think there are very, very active white churches now on all sorts of causes. But yes, I think people traditionally try to separate those.
Yeah, I can remember when I was living in New York City, for example, going to some black churches where they were quite open in preaching politics and talking about political issues. And you wouldn't hear this in most white churches at the time. So.
I think that's right. And there was a division, of course, within the black church and the black churches over this issue. There were movement churches, and there were churches that stuck to the scripture and stayed out of it.
Right.
There were lots of those, too.
Is there anything that prepared these particular neighborhoods for what happened? I mean, were there any telltale signs that when you looked back at them that you could sort of foresee that something was going to happen in this particular neighborhood?
I don't think so. I think that segregation existed everywhere. The conditions for a national kind of movement could have started anywhere. It started in Montgomery, many believe, but it could just as easily have started in any of 10 towns in Alabama and any of 7 different states. I think it's almost by chance that that it started there, because the same conditions existed everywhere, and it was a combination of those preconditions and the leadership being there. I guess the one common thread is that there was always in movement towns a educated and organized group of people that were ready to fight for this. And then sometimes that came in the form of people who were school teachers, people who worked on the railroad, people who were union leaders, and they were used to organizing and good at it. And I think that's a key factor. But why the voting rights campaign ended up in Selma as opposed to Tuskegee, it's hard to know why. And I think that's one of the fascinating things for me, was to find out how it differed from Kennedy.
Sure. Once started, then things must have been radically transformed in these neighborhoods, no matter where the event occurred. Peaceful neighborhoods must have become quite violent. Can you give me any examples of that?
Well, the best example is this neighborhood in Birmingham, which was a quiet, rolling residential neighborhood on Center Street, which became known as Dynamite Hill because there were so many bombings there. What happened was it was divided right down the middle, black and white. Blacks began to buy homes in the white neighborhood. starting in the 40s, there were bombings of those houses, and those continued for about 10, 15 years unsolved. And that became almost an armed camp. I mean, I went up there and spoke with some of the residents who were around from that time, and they really made it sound like it had become sort of a guerrilla battleground for a short while. So that was surely a big transformation for that neighborhood. But I mean, in general, what I saw was that the political transformation was quite radical. That is, the city councils and local governments had had fully changed over and become a power-sharing arrangement, whereas a lot of the customs and the economic conditions hadn't changed that much at all. And that was the sort of the big distinction right. that I saw going back to these times.
Well, interesting. Well, now we still have some weeks left of summer. Let's assume someone's going to run down to the local bookstore and pick up your book and decide to take their summer vacation in the South, looking at civil rights locations. One of the disappointments I've had in the past is I will go to look for an historic site, and I get there, and the only thing left is a marker. What are right. they going to find when they get there?
Well, there are quite a few civil rights sites still standing that are very evocative and very moving. I have plenty that I could recommend. I'd recommend that you go in a car that has air conditioning, which I didn't have the luxury of when I started doing this book. But at any rate, I'd say at least three-quarters of the sites in my book are still standing and in some kind of recognizable condition. And the churches are very open. I went to many, many services, and those are good places to go to get a feel for what it was like. Also, the houses are quite evocative, those that are still standing.
So it is still possible to get a sense of the time, even if many of the sites have been lost?
Yes. I mean, it varies. In the big cities, the onslaught of urban renewal wipes out a lot of things. But in the smaller towns, Selma, Alabama, for example, is basically a time capsule. Every single building of significance during the movement, except maybe one, is still standing and looks exactly as it did.
Interesting. Well, you offered, we'll take you up on your offer. We almost always do an historic site of the week, so we're going to let you do it, seeing you volunteered. Why don't you pick out one or two that you were particularly struck by that you think the listeners might want to visit?
Well, I think a good site, if you're interested in the life of Dr. King, and it's not very often visited, is his home in Montgomery. Now, this was owned by the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, his first church. It's at 309 South Jackson Street in downtown Montgomery. It's currently still owned by the church, not occupied, but you go there and you can see where Dr. King set up his first home during the Montgomery bus boycott. And in addition, there is a little plaque on the front porch where a bomb was tossed and exploded. Dr. King's wife and a friend and his first child were in the house at the time, were not harmed, but it was a critical event in terms of Dr. King embracing nonviolence, which was a new concept to him at the time. At any rate, it's a small house that could easily be missed driving by. I think there is a marker there now. But I like going there. It really makes me think about him and about his predecessor, Vernon Johns, who was also a pastor at Dexter, spoke very eloquently and passionately about equal rights. So that's something that's a little bit off the beaten track, but nice to see.
Okay, that's 309 South Jackson Street in Montgomery, Alabama, the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church and King's Home.
That's right. Well, the church is on Dexter Avenue itself, not far from there. But
right.
you could do both in a,
Great.
In a course of an hour.
Okay. Well, we're down to a little over a minute or so, and I wanted to say that I thought was a wonderful story for last, and that is, could you tell us where you got the title of the book?
Yes, this never wavered from 10 years ago. It comes from a story from the Montgomery bus boycott. There was an older woman who was joining the boycott and who was walking to work. And during that time, many of the movement people were giving rides. And one of them came by and said, excuse me, miss, would you like to have a ride instead of walking? She said, oh, no, thank you. My feet are tired, but my soul is resting. And when Dr. King heard that, used it in his speeches, and it was one of his favorite one of his favorite stories that he used over and over again.
That's a wonderful story, and I think it just adds a nice touch to the book as a whole, which, again, to our listeners, is a great book. We recommend it to you. Take it with you on your travel this summer. So, thank you, Mr. Davis, for taking the time to be with us today. I know you're very busy, and we appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Great. Hope to talk to you again.
I hope so. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Townsend Davis, author of Weary Feet, Rested Souls, A Guided History of the Civil Rights Movement, and this is Talking History.
Soon one morning,
death comes a creeping in the room. Soon one morning,
old man,
death comes a creeping in the room.
For this week's radio op-ed piece, that segment in which we ask historians to provide their perspective on items in the news, we have with us John H. Summers. Mr. Summers is pursuing a doctorate in American history at the University of Rochester. The subject of his op-ed piece for today is the politics of civility.
Advocates of civility insist that Americans stop attacking the character of our elected leaders. We should resist such preaching. For the last successful effort to insulate politicians from personal assault heralded the decay of democratic culture and the rise of elitist notions of government. From the very beginning of the American Republic, political criticism trained its fire in the private character of elected officials. Traditional notions of deference for leaders began to recede in the 1780s and 90s, and a fierce brand of political combat emerged in their place, one which regarded private life as a legitimate field of battle. The intense scrutiny aimed at personal morality stemmed from a shared belief that a just polity demanded evidence of private as well as public virtue. Thus, for much of the next century, virtually every important political figure, from Thomas Jefferson to Grover Cleveland, suffered from allegations of illegitimacy, drunkenness, or sexual misbehavior. Beginning in the 1890s, however, revelations of moral turpitude among politicians steadily retreated from public view. From the election of William McKinley until the disclosure of Gary Hart's adultery in 1988, reticence largely held sway. Contemporary critics, who wax nostalgic about this development, rarely understand the elitism that underwrote it. For the disappearance of the unseemly side of the character question signaled neither the growing respectability of journalism nor the declining importance of character to political life. Reporters continued to gossip about celebrities and sports figures, after all, and candidates still offered themselves to voters as men of integrity, honor, and judgment. Rather, 20th century office holders were protected as part of a politics of insulation. That is, professional journalists early in this century concluded that government needed insulation from a mobbish and irrational public. Most forcefully articulated in the 1920s by journalists like Walter Lippmann, this elite-centered model of democracy regarded voters not as citizens with a stake in discerning the character of their leaders, but instead as easily manipulable commodities whose penchant for irrational judgment required guidance and control. The new protection afforded private life thus became only one aspect of a larger endeavor by elites to protect all operations of government from popular scrutiny. Before we return to the days when politicians were so insulated, we might revisit 19th century assumptions about personal character as a field of turbulent political debate. Far from alienating voters, this arrangement attracted the greatest levels of political participation in American history. We might also recollect that the emergence of insulation for politicians paralleled the steadily increasing power of the presidency, the reintroduction of hierarchy into our politics, and the ultimate betrayal of the democratic promise.
You've been listening to John H. Summers, PhD candidate in history at the University of Rochester. Mr. Summers' remarks come to us courtesy of the History News Service. And finally, our list of coming attractions. programs, upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else history-related that may be of interest to our listeners. First, if you're interested in the Incas, you may wish to visit Memphis, Tennessee Civic Center, the Pyramid. When the Incas of what is today Peru rose to power in the 12th century, they did not need a neighbor in any direction they would not conquer. As a result, at their peak of power, their empire included some 35 different cultures. The Memphis exhibit, called Ancestors of the Incas, the Lost Civilizations of Peru, contains over 300 objects from those cultures, including ceramics, tiles, jewelry, and mummies. The exhibit closes September 16th. Running through the end of September at the Smithsonian Institution Arts and Industries Building in Washington, D.C., is an exhibit titled Speak to My Heart, African American Communities of Faith and Society. The display focuses on the role of the Black Church in African American life. Complementing this show at the same location is an exhibit on three generations of African American women sculptors. Contact the Pyramid and the Smithsonian for further details on these exhibits. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our show. We invite you to send your comments or suggestions either by email to talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian Laveau.
I was standing by my window on a cold and cloudy day when I saw the birds come rolling, oh, to take my mother away. There's a better home awaiting.